faster together. This is Geek Confidential. Melody Akles. Welcome, Mel.
Hey, hey.
Also joining us is Mo Walker. Welcome, Mo.
Happy to be here and to fly further, faster, higher.
Together. This is going to be an interesting discussion because this is a movie that, for me, I was like, I enjoyed the Ms. Marvel series on Disney Plus, but Captain Marvel wasn't my favorite of the superhero characters. And Monica Rambeau is a character that we were introduced to as a child. We got to see her a little bit as an adult in WandaVision, but now they've brought these three characters together for the Marvels movie. But none of them were like some that I would consider like top tier, right? And then on top of all of that, the reviews for this movie were not that great. So I had some pretty low expectations. I knew that Iman Vellani was totally engaging in her series, but I was like, I don't know what I'm getting into. I'm not sure that they will have chemistry. And so I went to it with more than a little trepidation. Mel, what was your first impression of this film, briefly? Before we dive into the details.
I really had the opposite effect going into it. I really enjoyed Captain Marvel, the first movie. It's one that if I catch it on TV, I watch it every time. And then, of course, the Ms. Marvel series in Kamala Khan and her incredibly charming family. So I was excited to see, you know, what we're going to get. And honestly, it didn't disappoint me. I love the direction that they took in the film with the three ladies and their light powers and their switching powers all throughout. I thought that was a really kind of a twist on what we're normally seeing for our Marvel movies. And they have to learn how to work together, because isn't that ultimately what it's about? Working together as a team to defeat your villain. I thought it had its really funny moments. I thought it had good emotional moments too. I didn't have any issues. I thought overall the movie was really fun. And I liked too that it wasn't, you know, 2.5-3 hours long. I liked that we really got it done at 1.5 hour, 1:45. So I was overall pleased with everything I saw.
Mo, what was your first impression?
That the three leads definitely had a lot of great chemistry between them. I feel like the glue that held all three together was Imani Vellani's
absolutely
Kamala Khan. And easily you can see that the character's exuberance. Obviously, if you were familiar with the Ms. Marvel television series or streaming series, you know how infectious that character is and just how much that character loves the MCU and all of these characters. And I think that just having Kamala radiate that positivity really helped for me set the tone for this film. I've been a longstanding Carol Danvers fan from the comics, particularly her relationship with the X-Men characters. I feel as though the MCU films, particularly that first Captain Marvel movie, really cut away the fat and left a very lean version of Carol Danvers that didn't go through all the damage that character went through in the comics. I do feel from my perspective that I love the character moments between the three leads. I would have enjoyed a little bit more time to simmer in that, particularly the Monica Carol relationship. I feel as though I could have gotten another 5 or 10 minutes of just the, you know, that relationship simmering a bit more before it sort of reached a crescendo. But overall, as Mel said, I really appreciated the fact that this was, you know, a movie that lasted under 2 hours. Okay. It didn't drag itself out or anything that nature. And I do feel like the criticism and the critiques that have been laid against this movie are a bit unnecessary. I mean, the harshness of the critiques. I think from a financial standpoint, sure, you can have some critiques, but I think from in terms of what you feel coming out of this film, I think it's probably one of the best examples of a fun Marvel film that we've gotten in a very long time.
I thoroughly enjoyed this film. I went in with super low expectations and I left thinking that it was the most fun I'd had at a Marvel movie in probably 5 years. Thor Ragnarok and the original Guardians of the Galaxy are probably my two favorite Marvel MCU movies for humor. And this one was right up there with it. Kamala, the character of Kamala and her family did so much to hold that film together, whether it was in the scenes with Nick Fury, with the parents and the brother, or if it was Kamala with Monica and Carol, like they were the glue. And then there was all of this like absurd humor that just sort of worked the same way that it worked with the original Guardians of the Galaxy, the same way it worked with Thor Ragnarok. I mean, we got a Disney princess out of the whole thing. I mean, technically, if you want to call it that, the conceit behind that planet's people was very interesting. And we can get into that later, but I just had a lot of fun with it. Like the movies recently that were supposed to be fun, like the most recent Thor, I was disappointed in because like the goats and the boat and the various other things that like, the last Thor movie was a little bit down because of Jane's storyline. I realize that's pulled from the comics and why they did it, but like the depiction in the film, in that film, was very jarring between everything that they were trying to balance. And it wasn't the same that I didn't feel the same way about that as I did Thor Ragnarok. But this was such a breath of fresh air. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it. It sort of made me think that this might have been what Ant-Man would have been if it had decent CGI. Like the great thing about Ant-Man is that it has such a family undertone to it. And the best parts of the Ant-Man movies are the family dynamics. It's not all the other stuff. So if you look at Ant-Man Quantumania, I enjoyed the family dynamics in that movie, but the other parts of that film weren't necessarily that great. But this film, you had the biological family, and then you had the newfound family that Kamala finds herself with, one of which is her idol. And it all just sort of worked for me. I was so impressed. Like, I can't believe I was so impressed by a Marvel movie this far in, but maybe it was just because I went in with such low expectations. Mel, you touched on it. What did you think of Kamala's family and their role in this film?
I adore her family. If there is anything in this movie that I think most people can relate to is her family and how they are such a true, strong family unit. Because at the end of the day, it is always about making sure the person that we love is protected. Forget, you know, my own safety, forget everyone else's. What is going on? Is the person that I love, are they okay? Do they need help? What can I do? And I loved seeing that dynamic between them. I mean, the fight that they had in the Khan house is probably one of my favorites in the whole movie, because they're watching their home get destroyed, and it's like, it's comedy, but the action scenes are really great, and but they're all still supporting Kamala, you know? So I love all of that. And even just throughout the movie, and you having them sprinkled in at just the right moments of, you know, maybe when things are looking a little dark, or when it looks like, uh-oh, we not gonna make it. Or, you know, just these funny moments of the family talking to Nick Fury. I love all of those things. And I really left the movie going, man, I really hope we get to see more of her family. I was like, I could go for a Miss Marvel season 2 at this point. But the family was that thing in Marvel movies that you look for. It's that thing of, oh, you know what? We might just be okay. And I love them. I love her, all of them.
Her mom is officially my favorite non-superpowered MCU character. When she came on that screen to go after Fury, and then those scenes that when she'd be on the screen with her daughter, like, I love her mother. Mo, what did you think of Kamala's bringing the family to the Marvels?
So I really think that that did a great job of kind of grounding this film and making it very relatable, because in the midst of planets with folks can sing and kittens that are devouring people.
Oh, you spoiled the part that I was going to bring up later.
Sorry.
Keep going.
Again, I want to say that that does a really good job of juxtaposing and keeping, you know, for the audience, making sure that the audience remembers what is the most important aspect of this film. It is that this family unit, you know, remains together. The Khans, they stick together through thick and thin. And I think that that is a lesson that it's clear that Carol and Monica seem to learn at the end of this film, because obviously, you know, they were a family unit from in the previous Captain Marvel film, obviously because of the 30-year time jump when Carol was away, and subsequently Monica becoming an adult and having to deal with all these issues, including the blip, the death of her mother, gaining powers during WandaVision and so forth. That family unit, that unit has, their relationship is fractured. And I think being able to see the Khans, how they interact with each other, even when things get really absurd, that they come through and pull through together, is a wonderful thing. I believe that, you know, as I like to call her, Mama Khan, you know that mother who is like, look, I don't care if, you know, you're with your idol, or, you know, if something happens, I'm going to hold them responsible, and, you know, nothing's going to stop me from ripping them to shreds. I mean, you know that family member. You have that family member who will do that for you. And I think that, again, bringing that piece of that series is a really key aspect of the Kamala Khan character that was not forgotten. And hopefully in future projects in which Miss Marvel appears, in some way, shape, or form, that family unit, the Khans, continue to make an appearance, because they are a foundational part of the Miss Marvel character.
I might get flamed for this on Twitter or social profiles, but like, I feel like they are as important to the next phase of the MCU as Aunt May is to Spider-Man, and Spider-Man's ethos within the MCU as it's been for the past decade or more, however long it's been. Like, I think that they are fundamental. The way that, like, I know that Miss Marvel, the TV series, isn't intended for all audiences, right? It's not necessarily intended for the audiences that see that go to the movies but don't necessarily keep up with the TV shows, right? But what they did with this film is they brought so much heart to it, the same way that May does for Spider-Man and Ground Spider-Man. And Miss Marvel was introduced in that series, or Kamala was introduced as Miss Marvel in that series really well. Unlike the character whose name I don't even remember, who came and appeared in Doctor Strange Multiverse of Madness, who just hopped through everything, like had no real reason for any of us to care about her. And she was just sort of there. Right? It was a plot point. Kamala is not that way. The way that they have introduced her with the TV series, the way they brought her family along on this film and provided so much heart, I really feel like whatever this next era is, that Kamala and her family are going to continue the legacy of Spider-Man and Aunt May in the first eras. I know I'm not going to call stages because like we've had the various like phases, but like whatever this next iteration is now that what's his name is back at Disney and he's reassessing everything in terms of quality and production. I realize that some things could change. So like whatever this next era is, I feel like Kamala and her family need to be as integral to it as Spider-Man was to the first what I'll call era.
So Luke, so the character you were talking about from referring to from Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness is America Chavez. And to be fair to the America Chavez character, you really haven't had, even in the comics, that much. That character hasn't had
right. But what I'm saying is, why would you I thought way back when that movie aired, that was the worst introduction of a teen character to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We have seen multiple teen superheroes introduced, and that one was categorically the worst. They gave us no reason to care about it other than in that movie. There was no setup, and it was terrible. That has nothing to do with the actress. I think that it has everything to do with the way the script was set up and what they were doing. They were like, oh, we're going to insert this character here. She'll be important sometime later. But they didn't give us a reason to care about her in that film. She just hopped all over and made Doctor Strange like chase after her for a bit and then hit her chase after him. You know, that was a terrible introduction. And go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, but you're absolutely correct that America Chavez was literally a plot device in that film, because the Multiverse of Madness had, you know, you had what was going on with Doctor Strange. You had the Scarlet Witch. That was enough plot right there. Plus you add in Chavez as a MacGuffin, and you really don't, there wasn't enough, like you said, there wasn't enough setup for us to emotionally invest in that character. And if you are a fan of the comics, you know what that character signifies and what they're trying to build long term. But again, you're right, Luke, that if you want us to care about a character like America Chavez, you know, as opposed to how we've had, you know, six episodes of Ms. Marvel plus this film, the film does a really good job of very quickly just showing us why we should care about this film.
You could have watched the Marvels, never known a thing about the Ms. Marvel TV series, and immediately fall in love with Ms. Marvel and Kamala the way that she was handled in this film. The same cannot be said for America Chavez in Multiverse of Madness. You don't, like, they did almost nothing other than an end scene where she's reflecting on what happened in the past. Like, they did almost nothing in that film to make us care about that character. She was just a MacGuffin. And I think that they did the actress a disservice. I think they did the character a disservice. Like, it's fine to have Easter eggs for people, but if you're going to try and pull in the masses with a lot with character, like the masses to a movie audience, not a television audience, like you have to set those characters up in a way that makes them immediately compelling for the audience. And I left that film not caring one iota about that character.
Mel?
I mean, okay, I can agree that the introduction of America Chavez's character was poor, because it was. She came literally running on screen with alternate version Dr. Strange that we don't care about. So that part I definitely understand. But from what I'm hearing from Mo, because I don't know much about the comic version, is that she isn't well fleshed out in the comics either. So she's still kind of new. So maybe there is some leniency I can grant there from going from the print comic version to the live action version. Would I have liked to seen her before? Yes. But that's not what we got. But there has to be a reason for why she just randomly all of a sudden showed up in a major Marvel movie in Multiverse of Madness, because this is the true introduction of the multiverse. And yes, her purpose in that film was all plot, but we know that she's one of the few characters that can jump universes. So I know that's going to come back eventually. I guess I'm kind of on the fence. Like, I don't necessarily think that it was the worst thing to ever happen. I just think it could have been done much better.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that went really well in this film. Mel, what did you think of the Carol and Monica dynamic? Because I personally have struggled with Carol as a character, because she comes across as so detached. And Monica is a character that we haven't spent as much time with as like the adult character, right? Mm-hmm. And so both that makes it difficult for me as a viewer to be invested in both of those characters. But I thought the film did a really good job by using those devices so that all three of them could see the memories. And they brought so much humanity through that little clever twist, if you want to put it that way, to make you feel, because on one hand you had Monica and she was just angry because she was abandoned, but you didn't really necessarily know what that meant. And then on the other hand, you had Carol, who's like cold and reserved because she's been so far away and she's been alone. And she's also like trying not to hurt this girl, but neither of those two things make necessarily you want to feel for those characters, at least me. And it wasn't until they used those devices to see each other's memories where I then began to feel for both of those characters and the situations that they'd been in.
I immediately wanted to know more about the Carol-Monica relationship, because in the original film, you know, Monica was just a little girl. You know, she couldn't have been more than, what, 10 or 11? And,
right,
you know, Carol was already this grown adult who was missing parts of her history, but she knew, for the most part, she knew she had this best friend in Monica's mother. So, Maria. And we know that, you know, now there's so much time that has passed. Monica is grown up, and we could tell that there was already some tension there between Monica and Carol, because anytime, even in, you know, going back to WandaVision, where somebody would say something about Carol, Monica would kind of like roll her eyes and she'd be like, I don't want to hear about it. And it was like, oh, there's something clearly happened here, because she was all about Carol when she was a kid. You know, she wore her leather jacket all the time. You know, she was always talking about her mom, because that was like her mom's best friend. And I think that's another point, too, is that when your mom's best friend is already your aunt, like low key, especially in Black households, like your mom's best friend, okay, that's my auntie, like that's who it is, we don't ask no questions, it's cool. But to have that disconnect going in, I thought was really interesting, and we knew they were gonna have to fill in the gaps somehow. And I think the memories machine that they had, where they put on their heads and they all sit together, I thought that was a really great way to tie them all together, because it helps us see what happened rather than tell us, oh, X, Y, and Z happened, blah, blah, blah. I got to see everything. That is important, because it helps me connect more with the characters, and especially to know that Carol was there for Maria while she was going through her cancer battle, because Monica had blipped. So she was gone. So to know that Carol was there even through you know, while she was trying to save other universes is huge. But Monica didn't know that because she was gone. So I think that part of it too really helps to try and bridge those gaps between the characters. And as the movie goes on, you really see Monica kind of soften towards Carol, and Carol, you know, admit the reasons why she stayed away so long. It wasn't because that necessarily she wanted to be away. It's felt, she felt like she had to because of everything that she did. So, and it's also learning people's motivations behind why they necessarily stayed away from you. Wasn't because I didn't love you. Wasn't because I didn't want to be around you. I kind of felt like I wasn't worthy to be around you. And that's a whole different thing. So I love the way that they told that story in this film. And I really hope we get to see more healing between them.
Well, that brings me to another element of this film that was also interesting, shall we say. The basic premise of this plot is the is that Darben is terraforming planets, or reverse terraforming them, in order to suck the resources from the specific planets back into her homeworld and save her homeworld. And Carol Danvers, when she went and back in the Captain Marvel movie, destroyed, and I don't remember the name of it, but like the big intelligence that was
the Supreme Intelligence.
Thank you. The Supreme Intelligence, when she destroyed the Supreme Intelligence, basically became responsible for what the state that this planet is in now. And so Darben is basically going to these other planets, reverse terraforming them, sucking all of those assets back into the her homeworld and trying to save her homeworld. Which is a compelling story for the, how do I put this? It makes you care about a villain when you wouldn't, which would have otherwise been one note. And the, for a lot of the movie, until I understood exactly why she was reverse terraforming these planets, I thought that Darben came across as was the weakest link in the film. To me, she was very one-dimensional, very wooden. But then I got thinking, once the revelation about why she was doing it, how the Earth was dying, her planet was dying, and then I got thinking, while I'm still in the film, about how the Kree were first introduced and how, like, back in, well, I'm not saying first introduced, but where I remember them most, is in Guardians of the Galaxy, when Star-Lord and company had to face off against what's his name. And I'm like, okay, that was also someone that was very, it was almost like Vulcan-like. This, the Kree seemed to be Vulcan-like in terms of at least the leaders in terms of lack of emotion. So maybe this is a race thing for the Kree. Mo, what did you think of Darben? What did you think of her plot to save her planet?
So I agree with you about understanding Darben's motivation. I understood, you know, that from the ramifications of destroying the Supreme Intelligence. I do wish that they had stayed with that a bit longer, particularly because it was pretty much a blip, and you saw Carol just fly in, wipe out the Supreme Intelligence. And then the Kree homeworld fell apart. Okay.
And they did all of that through flashbacks. And they did whatever correct. They did.
Yeah, and they did that through flashbacks. So part of me wonders, you know, in terms of sequencing, perhaps they had, if they'd put that sequence at the beginning of the film, because remember, you know, at the end of the last Captain Marvel film, it literally was Carol saying, I'm coming, tell the Supreme Intelligence, I'm coming for it. So I think that, you know, had that occurred sooner, maybe the audience would have connected to Darben sooner, because that's something like a number of Marvel films. It's a sort of a trick that they've done, including going back to Thor, Love and Thunder, where we find out the villain's motivation really early on in the film. That's probably one of the key opening sequences. So I think that that would have helped in terms of that.
Is the race more Vulcan-like just in the comics, or is that just a, like, my rationalization for why she was a little bit wooden?
I think it's probably like a combination of both. I mean, the Kree in the comics, I mean, one, you got the different hues. You got the blue and you got the white ones and so forth. Those are the two primary colors that we see them come in. I think that, again, their whole culture is built, particularly in the comics, around the Supreme Intelligence. And the Supreme Intelligence dictates all. And so there is, I would say, there is this sort of very logical, but it's a logic, and it's also this sort of warrior culture as well, because they are conquerors. So remember that that was a key aspect of the first Captain Marvel film, is that this is a warrior culture, that they are somewhat driven by logic. And I think that certainly carries into the Marvels. It's just that I also believe that was the actress's choice to deliver her
lines. Or the director's choice.
Or the director's choice, yes.
Mel, what did you think of her as a villain?
I do think she was the weakest part of the film, because mostly what you and Mo were talking about, I wanted to see more from her. Like, I get your motivation, you know, Carol destroyed the Supreme Intelligence, which in turn really destroyed your planet the way that you knew it. So that part I can understand, which is kind of the motivation for many of the villains in a lot of the space movies. So that part I can understand, but I just wish we could have seen a little bit more. Like, okay, I get your initial motivation, but what is keeping you going like this to where you're not stopping until somebody's head rolls? Like, I just needed more, basically. I mean, she had a little goons rolling with her, but I didn't think they were particularly menacing either. It was okay. Like, it served its purpose for the movie, but I did feel
it
like
felt
that was
a little, it felt a little bit henchman.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I just felt like we could have did a little bit more with that. So
I'm trying to think here for a second, because I feel like I might be going into something. Which movie was it where they'd set everything in the 80s? Was that a DC movie? I'm trying to forget the movie.
Are you thinking about 1984?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, no.
No.
Where it was an alternate Earth, and they all had animal versions. No, that was a Marvel movie, right?
What? Well, remember, the first Captain Marvel film was set in the 90s.
No. There is a superhero movie that came out that I really wanted to forget about because it was awful, in which there was some sort of, the movie itself wasn't bad. The conceit was bad. The most recent Guardians of the Galaxy, where they end up on that planet that is basically like 1980s present, and all of the people aren't people, they're animal people.
So you're talking about Counter-Earth, and
yes.
There you go.
Yeah, so okay.
So like, to me, like, I listen. Raccoon Story was amazing in that film, and I love the Guardians of the Galaxy, but I did not need to be there for that villain on that planet, or have as much time spent on that planet as was spent on that planet. And that's sort of how I feel about Darben. But maybe that's just,
maybe if she had like somebody else with her, or somebody she was answering to that was more menacing, it would have worked better. But it just being her, she needed something
well,
else to help
and
out.
Am I wrong in that? Is that the same hammer from the Guardians of the Galaxy 1 movie?
That is the same. What's his name? Ronan?
Yeah.
Ronan the Accuser. Yes.
Yeah. That's the
similar,
same hammer.
That's the
is
same
it the
type
same,
of hammer. Yeah.
Is it the same type of hammer or the same hammer?
The same type.
Let me get it right. Same type.
And that was the thing that as I was watching the movie, I was like, he was very menacing and scary, and she was not. Like, the fight scene where all three of them took her on showed us that she was very powerful. But outside of that fight scene, I was not worried for any of their safety. Were you?
Well, I will say no, given the tone of this film. I felt like the jeopardy was going to come from somewhere else. I will say, to be fair to the Guardians of the Galaxy 3, I did feel like, you did feel like, in my opinion, that the High Evolutionary was very menacing because of the bit of the body horror that was going on in that film.
Oh, but I agree. The Guardian, and when I spoke earlier, because I couldn't remember which movie it was that I was thinking of, I enjoyed Guardians of the Galaxy 3 more than Guardians of the Galaxy 2 because of the cat, like the Guardian dynamic and how that all played out. And I thought that the plot was technically a better plot line, but I did not need to spend a whole bunch of time with animal people on a planet that is the equivalent of the 1980s. That just was my thing against it. Let's talk about a character we haven't talked about a lot. Nick Fury, Mo, he had his own TV series that was widely panned, to be nice. I enjoyed it. I'm this person who, like, I feel like I am the opposite Marvel fan, because Mo went and posted something in the Facebook group, the Geek Confidential Facebook group, about the what ifs that Marvel is releasing. And I'm like, am I the only one who does not enjoy what ifs? And everybody else seems to love them. And so in this case, the Nick Fury series, which was widely panned, I enjoyed. And so to see Nick Fury now in this movie, I was like, okay, I enjoy this version of Nick Fury more than the TV series, but him with the cons, his interaction with the three superheroes, the three women, I thought that that was a lot of fun. And then the plot line about the cat and the kittens, that plot line with the cat and the kittens is the most fun that I have had at a Marvel movie since Thor Ragnarok, and they went up the anus in the spaceship and were being chased and glitter distraction was going everywhere as they were fleeing. I thoroughly enjoyed it. So Mo, Nick Fury transitioning into kittens.
Well, Luke,
I know it's a lot.
Yeah, you know, well, at least he didn't have to deal. At least, you know, we're not dealing with Nick Fury in a rectal exam. You know, but anyway, I will say first about Secret Invasion. Yeah, Luke, I struggled a bit with that. I struggled with the No Country for Old Men version of Nick Fury. I feel as though the Marvels, we've gotten back to more of the Nick Fury. I wouldn't say he's an upbeat Nick Fury by any stretch of the imagination.
No, but the cons provided all of the humor there.
Correct. And he was a good foil for the cons. What I feel is though he was competent in the Marvels versus Secret Invasion, in which I feel as if he was being led along for the better part of those six episodes. I'm gonna say that, you know, I appreciate an introspective Nick Fury, right? And I think that it could, again, Secret Invasion could have been done a bit better if they were going to do a lot of the introspection that they did. However, I do feel like even in the Marvels, we get a Nick Fury that understands, you know, the consequences of what his life has led to, and the fact that, you know, there has been hardship and pain, but at the same time, there has been humor and love. And I really felt that in the Marvels.
And what did you think of the kittens?
Oh, the Flarkins. So Here's the thing. I'm gonna put this out there. I'm not a big cat person. So, but I do appreciate the fact that, you know, you have these cats that like devour people, and that they were being used as an offensive weapon and a defensive and a defensive weapon, i.e., you know, the plot device that saves everybody in the end. I do wish, you know, I think we got the right amount of Flarkins. It wasn't like Thor Love and Thunder, where I think that any of the animal characters that were involved, it just went a little overboard. I think we got the right amount of balance with those characters in this film.
Mel, what did you think of Fury and the Flarkins?
I mean, if we're going to start with Secret Invasion, I think Secret Invasion started out really strong, but the finish was really disappointing. Like, I haven't been that deterred from a season finale of a Marvel show in a while. I was like, ugh, what a way to completely ruin everything. But besides the point, Fury in the Marvels, we kind of see him as more of a return to form as the Fury that we know, you know, kind of overseeing everything, taking charge when he needs to, and really just kind of being the man in the shadows for our heroes, which is fine. But I did like the moments with the family that he had with the family, because it was definitely more classic Fury. So I love those moments. And we see him, you know, as we're getting back to Earth, making sure everybody gets back. I think one of the funniest scenes in the whole movie is when they're on the rescue pods trying to get back to Earth, and Kamala Khan's brother is praying, and Fury yes. is like, what are you doing? Are you praying? Oh, okay. And he stops and he's like, don't stop. What are you doing? Keep going. And then he's just like, amen, amen. I was like, that is brilliant. I think all of that is hysterical. So we see more of the Fury that we know. And then getting to the Flarkins, I think they are incredibly adorable. And I in real life, I am very, very allergic to cats. So this is really the closest that I can get to them, is watching them on screen. So I love the part in the movie where everything's really falling apart on the Sword space station. And over the intercom, you can hear someone saying, please let the Flarkins eat you. And everyone is running. And I was like, this is more of the Marvel comedy that I really enjoy. So
yes, that's like, it was the most fun. And then Mama Khan holding it and chasing, I was like, oh, I am here for every single moment of it.
It was so great. And I didn't expect the main fucking Goose. I didn't expect Goose to be pregnant. I was like, first of all, how you got knocked up? Okay. But anyways, because I'd only ever seen you, but maybe you could do it your own. I don't know. Anyways, but all the little super adorable little kittens who are completely deadly is really funny and really cute, and a really smart way to get a whole bunch of people off of a space station onto Earth. So I thought they did a really great job with that. And it's just the fact that you have these really powerful characters who are just really tiny little cute kittens. So there you go.
So I guess my question should be for Mo. Is there some sort of storyline in the Marvel universe in which a whole bunch of Flarkins are required? Because I'm trying, like, that cat is extremely powerful and has shown up in like moderation, extreme moderation throughout the various movies. And now there's a crap load of them.
So I will say that the Flarkins are a thing in the comics, as in addition to another aspect of this film we have yet to touch upon.
Well, bring it up now.
The Prince Jan.
Oh, subplot. we were going to him next. So okay, you can finish this up.
So I was going to say, yes, so the Flarkins are definitely a thing. To the extreme that they're being used to transport humans from exploding satellites to Earth. I'm not sure, because it does tonally fit what we would get in these Carol Danvers, Captain Marvel comics, probably within the last 6 to 8 years. So I would definitely be curious if there are specific issues or storylines in which the Flarkens are the quote unquote heroes. So
okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about Prince Yon. The premise of the story, as mentioned earlier, is the fact that Darben is basically reverse terraforming these planets, and she's going to each planet for specific resources. Prince Yon's planet has a lot of water, so she is going there to suck it all up and put it on her planet. And this is where we and Monica and Kamala find out that Carol Danvers is married to Prince Yon, is a Disney princess. There's some sort of magic or technology that appears like magic that can literally turn Carol Danvers into a princess. And then their entire form of communication is singing. At first blush with this, when it very first started, the singing started, I was like, what kind of hokey shit is going on? But then it expanded and suddenly it made some sort of real illogical sense. And I was enjoying every single minute of it. Before we get to Mo's explanation about Prince Yon and I'm sure their culture, Mel, what was your reaction to this twist?
Okay, so spoiler alert, Melody loves musicals. So as soon as they were like, we speak and sing song, I was all about it. I was like, yep, let's do it. I'm ready. So I love the planet they went to. I love all the brilliant, beautiful colors that everyone wore. You know, we're speaking and sing song. So it was everything that I personally enjoy. But I also thought it served as a really great way to soften Carol a little bit more.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, this is the first time we really saw her, you know, outside of her Captain Marvel uniform where she always ready to kick butt. But this time, you know, she had her little princess crown thing on. Then she went, she danced with the prince in that dress, baby. She looked good in that. I said, girl, you better go off. Versatility, ma'am. I see you. So I love that they found a way to kind of naturally soften her. And she also mentioned, she was like, listen, sometimes to get jobs done, you got to get married. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, they said I don't have to stay, so it's fine. So it's like, she knows exactly what she's doing and she gets to have a little fun at the same time. So I loved Prince Yon and the planet. He was cute too. And
oh, so, he was so hot. I was like, oh my God, was he hot.
To be completely shallow, I was here for all of it. And it was fun too, because then you finally got to see Monica and Kamala's reactions, and they were like, what is going on here? Is she for real? Oh, this is happening. Okay, well, I guess we're doing it. And there's one scene where Kamala is like dancing to all the songs and the music, like she's completely in it, and Monica is still like, I don't know about this, like, I mean, I guess we're doing it, but maybe. So it was a really fun planet, a really fun sequence to really just lighten things up and give more depth to Carol to make sure that, you know, she's not all hard all the time.
Mo, what did you think of Prince Yon? What did you think of the planet, and how does it tie into the comics?
So yeah, for in terms of Prince Yon, you know, I'm glad that character was used to soften Carol. I kind of wish we kind of got a little bit more at the end to like wrap their story up, because I feel like we kind of got left hanging there.
We don't know if they actually survived.
Yeah, and which is a shame, because I would welcome seeing more MCU characters visiting that planet, whether it's this new version of the Guardians, you know, Thor and company, whomever. But I think that there is potential for some additional stories set on that planet. Now, to answer your question about Prince Yon in the comics, there is definitely a Prince Yon in the comics. The relationship with Carol was a little bit different. It was another character who was married to Prince Yon in the comics. But again, I have to appreciate that, like the Flarkens, they're lifting a lot of a large portion of this film, at least certainly not plot wise, but tonally, from the Kelly Sue DeConnick and the Kelly Thompson eras of the Captain Marvel series. And, you know, if you like the tone of this, of the Marvels, I think that you would probably definitely want to read some of the Captain Marvel comics that were set, that these two ladies have written.
Okay. Well, as one would expect, the Marvels save the day. Earth is saved. And you sit through the credits and we get to the end. And Miss Kamala is putting together the Young Avengers. Mel, did you ever read the Young Avengers comics?
I did not. Okay. I know of them, but I haven't read them. I'm sorry.
So I did read some of the earlier ones. Mo, I'm excited for this. This was not, like, because of the TV series, I knew that this was sort of an eventuality, but I was thinking that other characters might be the lead on that. But Kamala is the one who's going to bring them all together. What did you think of that spoiler, Easter egg, whatever you want to call it, for Young Avengers?
I think it fits perfectly with what we've been getting, because quite frankly, you can't do the Young Avengers as they were in that comic from 2005, 2006. Not in terms of how you're putting the team together. Plus, you've already added...
Well, half of those characters aren't even in the MCU as we know it, right?
Probably the biggest player amongst that group is Iron Lad. And, you know, if you know who Iron Lad is supposed to be, you know, I don't think they want to necessarily go down that rabbit hole, given the problems that they're already dealing with the adult version of that character. So I will say that it just feels natural that that Kamala would be the one instigating this new team of Young Avengers. Clearly, you know, hopefully America Chavez would be part of this unit. Maybe they could use this as an avenue to redeem that character. But definitely I'm hoping that at this point that maybe we'll get a Young Avengers team on the big screen instead of on a streaming series, because I remember there were always rumors about Young Avengers being a streaming series, but I think at this point we actually want an Avengers team. And I don't think folks care if there's an adjective, you know, like young or new. We just want an Avengers team. And I think one comprised of Kamala and even let's throw in like Peter Parker.
I was going to say, if they bring Peter Parker, they have Kate Bishop and Kamala. That is a pretty strong foundation. And we already had Young Hulkling introduced in, was it She-Hulk?
She-Hulk at the end. Yeah.
Yeah.
No. That wasn't Hulkling.
No,
that
it was Scar.
Scar.
That was Scar.
You're right.
I'm
thinking the wrong one.
Hulkling is technically a, Hulkling is a Kree, is Kree and a Skrull, is half Kree, half Skrull.
Okay. So final thoughts and ratings out of five Marvels, how many Marvels do you give this film, Mo?
I'll give it 4 Marvels out of a 5.
Mel, how about you?
4.3 Marvels out of 5.
And I'm giving them 4.5. Any final thoughts on this before I pull a Luke and bring up one final surprise topic for the end of this podcast? So any final thoughts on the Marvels, Mel?
I just wanted to say, because we did not talk about the Bangles, and the Bangles were very much part of the plot in this one, in that we knew there was another one out there. The villain in this one found it. That's how she was getting all of her powers. But they did eventually get the Bangles back, and now Kamala has both Bangles, and I'm very interested to see how much that's going to amplify her powers as we go further into the MCU.
Well, and she's now the one who can basically do all kinds of hopping. Mo, any final thoughts?
I think that people need to be more fair to this movie. I think that you can separate the fact that from a financial standpoint, it didn't do as well as expectations. But I think, again, the deck was stacked against this film for a number of reasons, including the strikes. And so I think that folks really need to be a bit kinder. And if you're gonna have a critical opinion on this film, see the film, not just bash it online.
Well, now is the time for a hard left curve, but we're gonna stay in the Marvel universe. Oh, wait! We can't go to that quite yet. Monica Rambeau ended up in an alternative world, and Kelsey Grammer. Mel, what did you think?
Okay, y'all know me. Y'all know I've been waiting for these X-Men to really officially appear in the MCU. We got a little small taste of it in Multiverse of Madness when they had Professor X show up as Patrick Stewart in the yellow hover chair and the green suit. I'm still fangirling over that. But now, here we are. It's officially happening in the extra credit scene. Monica wakes up. She sees her mother, or who she thinks is her mother. She's freaking out. She's apologizing. And Maria is like, girl, I don't know you. I don't know what you're talking about. And you kind of see this blue fuzz dance across the screen. And in the theater, I said, was that Beast? And sure enough, it was Kelsey Grammer coming back to portray Beast. He was in the Sony movies as Beast. So once again, Marvel is meshing all of the previous films with the current MCU, which makes me very happy. And I felt this version of Beast was a little bit more comic accurate because they had his fangs sticking up out of his mouth. So all of that made me very happy. And if you look around at the set, it looked like it was some of that old Fox X-Men set. Oh, it was all for me fan service. I loved every part of it. And I can't wait to see how they eventually bring her back. Because, you know, when in whatever universe she's in, like, these are the for real X-Men. Beast was talking about Charles knowing that she was there. We got to give him updates. I'm like, oh, well, let's just bring everybody on. So I'm curious to see if they are really going to bring everybody from those Fox movies, or if it's just going to be Beast. And we know Hugh Jackman is going to appear in Deadpool. So I'm like, who else we got? I'm ready.
Well, what's interesting about that is I think that the Loki season 2 is pretty much explaining how these are going to end up coming together because of everything that is going on in that series. It's been a little bit difficult of a season to watch. It's not quite like, there's been some motivation issues that took a while to get established, but the overall premise of what's going on, I mean, I fully believe that some universes are going to be getting folded and that certain characters will be coming from different places. And what I think is interesting about the introduction of the X-Men in this manner is that technically it could still be Kelsey Grammer's Beast, but not in the same universe as the Fox movies. It's just that he's consistent between those two universes. And so if he comes into the third universe where our Avengers world have been established, technically he doesn't have to be from the Fox X-Men. He could be from a different one, which is
true,
which is entirely possible. But Mo, I will have you weigh in on Beast and the introduction of the X-Men in this manner, because then we are going to go to the casting reports about Reed Richards.
So I was really happy to see Kelsey Grammer turn up as Beast. I was waiting for that, the da-na-na-na-na-na, that chord, the strike, you know, but we didn't get that. Unlike in the Multiverse of Madness, I do appreciate that, again, they're pulling from X-Men comics with Maria being binary, who in X-Men comics was one of Carol's personas when she received got a new set of powers. So I like that they have incorporated that into the films. Just thinking about your possibilities for the Beast, I'm having flashbacks to Arrowverse and the Crisis and Worlds Will Live and Worlds Will Die, Luke.
Right, so, but like that's at a television level. Let's face it, they didn't have Feige, so like I feel like we're in much better hands. But even still, like even if you look at the Arrowverse and everything that happened in Crisis there. Technically, the way that Superman has been, is he or is he not the one that was the cousin of our Supergirl? Like, there's all kinds of things in there that are just as messy as what Marvel's trying to pull off. But Marvel, I trust Marvel more because of their track record.
Well, we are, after all, plus we all like mess from the M to the S.
Ooh, look at that. Using Mel's peg line. How dare you? So, Reed Richards. Word on the street and multiple places are reporting that Pedro Pascal, everybody's favorite Zaddy from The Mandalorian, from Game of Thrones, from The Last of Us, is being eyed and in negotiations for the role of Reed Richards in Marvel's introduction of the Fantastic Four into the MCU. Now, the Fantastic Four Marvel fans have been waiting for the Fantastic Four with as much anticipation as the X-Men in some corners. And so this is big news. I have to admit, I don't necessarily imagine Pedro Pascal as Reed Richards just because Reed Richards is so tall in everything that I've ever seen him in. But my rationale is this. Pedro Pascal is one, hot, two, he's a great actor, and three, CGI was going to make the character stretch anyways. So if it's going to stretch, then technically height doesn't have to matter. Mo, what do you think of these reports that Pedro Pascal could be Reed Richards?
Well, first off, my thinking is how does this impact The Mandalorian and these supposed films that The Mandalorian and Ahsoka are supposed to dovetail into?
I'm assuming that's the reason why Katie has been the focus of The Mandalorian season 3.
So, I mean, at this point, you know, I don't expect Pedro Pascal to wear the Vaskar armor and, you know, be under that helmet. But certainly he can do some voice work. But, you know, I feel like, let's just wait and see. I'm like, let's, until the ink
wait,
is dry.
You mean
on
to
that
tell
contract?
Me as a geek that you are not like foaming at the mouth to either love or hate this and be like, it's the worst thing ever or it's the best thing ever?
I'm too old to be foaming at the mouth like that. You know, I mean, like, seriously, look at how many times fans they've put a little leg out there and they pulled it away from us. From just any number of things. I'm like, at this point, let's just wait and see what happens.
According to Deadline, while the deal is far from done, sources tell Deadline that, I wanted to make sure I have it right, that negotiations are headed in the right direction, and Deadline would not be reporting it if that was not the case.
Well, I'm not saying that negotiations aren't heading in the right direction, but again, remember, this would be basically what, in third position to possibly even fourth position. Again, if you throw in The Mandalorian, you know, he's got Last of Us. It's been pushed back because of the strike. You've got that other film, the film he's working on, and I'm suffering from leukitis. I'm forgetting the film that he's supposed to be working on as well.
The man is booked and busy.
He's booked and busy.
Mel, what do you think of everybody's favorite Zaddy coming to the Marvel Universe as Reed Richards?
Now, y'all know I love me some Pedro Pascal. And if there's anybody who has range, it is that man. So do I think he's capable of doing it? Yes. But kind of piggybacking on what Mo is talking about, he is doing a lot of things right now. So I'm like, would he even have time to do Fantastic Four? I'm not opposed to him being casted, but I also have a question. What was wrong with John Krasinski? What was wrong with him? I thought he did a great job in Multiverse of Madness. So I was like, why don't we just get him to do it? But what do I know? I don't know anything. To answer your question, I don't have a problem with it.
Okay. Well, that's far less controversial than I was expecting to get from my co-host.
This is a Pedro-friendly podcast.
That is true. Well, but like, even though we're all fans of Pedro, that doesn't mean that what you envision for the character may or may not be filled by his portrayal, you know?
I don't know.
Well, we've had he will be the fourth.
Yeah. It's been a lot of them.
Yeah. Fifth, technically be the fifth live action version of Reed Richards, right? And they're clearly trying to go for something a little bit different in terms of their casting. Again, I'm like, let's just wait and see. And I did remember the movie he was supposed to be working on. It's the sequel to Gladiator. So again,
Gladiator 2.
Yeah. So I'm just like, again, I'm kind of torn because I'm like, Mel, well, what was wrong with John Krasinski? I did recall, I don't know, was it Deadline or was it some other outlet mentioned that Marvel wanted like a bigger name, and that was part of the reason why they're kind of hell bent on getting him. So,
I mean, again, John ain't nothing to shake a stick at. I mean,
I would say that in light of The Last of Us, The Mandalorian, and Game of Thrones, not to mention the fact that he appeared in the Wonder Woman movie, which there's a lot of terrible things that you can say about that Wonder Woman movie, but his professionalism and acting was not necessarily one of them.
No, he was okay Maxwell Lord. I just think that they gave him the wrong material for that character.
Yeah.
Well, we shall see if this comes to fruition. And on that note, we would encourage you to comment on this episode at geekconfidential.com. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/GKConfidential. Find us on Twitter, twitter.com/GKConfidential. You can find me on Twitter at Luke_Kurt. Mel is at Melody Akers. And Mo is at DrMo77. We thank you for listening. Until next time, so long.
Bye, y'all.
Bye, everybody.